vastly unpredictable thing.
Dad?
Jack turned to see Mickey standing behind him. She was in pajama bottoms and a t-shirt, with a scared look on her face.
Are you okay?
She said breathlessly.
I heard you yelling.
She wrapped her arms around his burly shoulders.
Dad, are you okay?
She asked again. He drew a long breath. I'm just trying to understand things that I don't think there's any way to understand.
Okay,
she said in a halting voice. He looked back at the palace. I moved all of us here for a really selfish reason. I wanted to be close to your mom again. She grew up here. Place was filled with stuff that belonged to her. Every day I'd find something else that she had touched.
I can understand that. I didn't want to come here at first, but now I'm glad I did.
She touched his arm.
I look at that photo of Mom you gave me every day. It makes me cry, but it also feels so good.
He pointed to the lighthouse. Do you want to know why I've been busting my butt trying to get that damn thing to work? She sat down next to him.
Because Mom loved it?
She said cautiously.
And she wanted you to repair it?
At first, I thought that too. But it finally just occurred to me when I saw you standing there. It was like a fog lifted from my brain. He paused and wiped his face with his sleeve. I realized I just wanted to fix something, anything. I wanted to go down a list, do what I was supposed to do, and the end result would be, presto, it works. Then everything would be okay again.
But it didn't happen.
No, it didn't. And you know why? Mickey shook her head. Because life doesn't work that way. You can do everything perfectly. Do everything that you think you're supposed to be doing. Fulfill every expectation that other people may have. And you still won't get the results you think you deserve. Life is crazy and maddening and often makes no sense. Jack paused and looked at his daughter. People who shouldn't be here are, and someone who should be here isn't. And there's nothing you can do about it. You can't change it. No matter how much you may want to. It has nothing to do with desire and everything to do with reality, which often makes no sense at all. He grew silent and looked out to the black ocean. Mickey leaned against him and gripped his hand.
We are here for you, Dad. I'm here for you. I'm part of your reality.
He smiled, and with that smile, her look of fear finally was vanquished. I know you are, baby. He hugged her. You know, I told you I was scared when my dad was dying, that I withdrew from everybody.
Yeah.
Well, when my mom left me, I pulled back even more. If it wasn't for your mother, I think I would have just kept pulling back until I disappeared. I played sports and all, but I didn't have many friends. I guess because I didn't want them. Then we got married and I went off to the military. Then when I got home, I picked a job that required a lot of hours and a lot of sweat.
You had to support your family.
Yeah, but in a way, I think I was still retreating, still trying to hide.
Dad, you were there for us.
I missed a lot of things I shouldn't have. I know it, and so do you. She squeezed his arm.
There's still a lot more to see.
Mickey said quietly. He nodded. There is a lot more to see, honey. A lifetime more. She shivered. He put his arm around her. Come on, let's go in. As they walked past the lighthouse, Mickey glanced at it and said,
Are you sure?
Jack didn't even look at it. I'm very sure, Mickey. Very sure. Chapter 54. After Jack got back to his room, he dropped, exhausted, onto the bed. But he didn't go to sleep. He lay there for a while, staring at the ceiling. Life was often unfair, insane, damaging. And yet the alternative to living in that world was not living in it. Jack had been given a miracle. He had already squandered large parts of it. That was going to stop. Now. He opened his nightstand and pulled out the stack of letters. He selected the envelope with the number 5 on it, slid out the letter, and flicked on the light. What he just told Mickey, he firmly believed, because he'd once written down these same sentiments. He had just forgotten, or, more likely, ignored them in his quest for the impossible. He began to read. Dear Lizzie, as I've watched things from my bed, I have a confession to make to you, and an apology. I haven't been a very good husband or father. Half our marriage I was fighting a war, and the other half I was working too hard. I heard once that no one would like to have on their tombstone that they wished they'd spent more time at work. I guess I fall into that category, but it's too late for me to change now. I had my chance. When I see the kids coming and going, I realize how much I missed. Mickey already is grown up with her own life. Corey is complex and quiet. Even Jackie has his own personality. And I missed most of it. My greatest regret in life will be leaving you long before I should. My second greatest regret is not being more involved in my children's lives. I guess I thought I would have more time to make up for it, but that's not really an excuse. It's sad when you realize the most important things in life too late to do anything about them. They say Christmas is the season of second chances. My hope is to make these last few days my second chance to do the right thing for the people that I love the most. Love, Jack. Jack slowly folded the letter and put it away. These letters, when he was writing them, were the only things he had left, really. They represented the outpouring from his heart, the sort of things you think about when the trivial issues of life are no longer important because you have precious little time left. If everyone could live as though they were in jeopardy of shortly dying, Jack thought, the world would be a much better place. But in the end, they were only letters. Lizzie would have read them, and perhaps they would have made her feel better. But they were still just words. Now was the time for action. He knew what he had to do. Be a father for my children. Repair that part of my life. Jack rose and went from room to room, checking on his kids. He sat next to Jackie as the little boy slept peacefully. His hand curled around his monster truck. Corey slept on his stomach, his arms coiled under him. A tiny snore escaped his lips. Next, Jack stood in the doorway of Mickey's room, watching the rise and fall of her chest, the gentle sound of her breathing. He closed her door and went downstairs and onto the rear screened porch. From here, he could see the lighthouse soaring into the sky. He had built it into some mythical symbol, but it was only a pile of bricks and cinder blocks and metal guts. It wasn't Lizzie. It had no heart. Not like the trio beating in the bedrooms above. Three people who needed him to be their father. In this last letter, he had been lamenting that there were no second chances left to him. Yet that insane, unfair world that he had sometimes railed against had done something remarkable. It had given him another shot at life. I'm done running. Jack went back to bed and slept through the night for the first time in a long time. Chapter 55. Beginning the next day, Jack literally hung up his tool belt for the rest of the summer. Instead of going to work, he drove Jackie and Corey to Ann Bethune's camp. And he didn't just drop them off and leave. He stayed. He sat and drew pictures and built intricate Lego structures with Jackie, and then, laughing, helped his son knock them down. He instructed Jackie on how to tie his shoes and cut up his food. He helped construct the sets for a play that Corey was going to be in. He also helped his oldest son with his lines. After camp, they would go to the beach, swim, build sandcastles, and throw the ball or the frisbee. Jack got some kites and taught the boys how to make them do loops and twisters. They found some fishing tackle under the deck of the palace and did some surf fishing. They never caught anything, but had great fun in their abject failure to hook a single fish. Jenna and Liam came by regularly. Sometimes Liam would bring his drums and he and Mickey would practice for the talent competition. Since the palace wasn't soundproofed, the pair would go up to the top of the lighthouse. That high up, their powerful sound was dissipated, although the seagulls were probably entertained. At least the lighthouse was good for something, thought Jack. He and Mickey took long walks on the beach, talking about things they had never talked about before. About Lizzie, and high school, and boys, and music, and what she wanted to do with her life. Mickey continued to waitress at the Little Bit. Jack and Sammy dropped in to eat frequently, and they also did some repairs for Jenna, but only because she refused to charge them for their meals. Charles Pinckney visited them at the palace. He would tell them stories of the past, of when Lizzie was a little girl about Jackie's age, and all of them would sit and listen in rapt attention, especially Jack. Jack took Jenna for rides on the Harley, and they were over at each other's homes for meals. They would take walks on the beach and talk. They laughed a lot and occasionally drew close, and arms and fingers touched and grazed, but that was all. They were friends. The summer was finally going as Jack had hoped it would. He would lie awake at night listening to the sounds in the darkness, trying to differentiate among his children's breathing. He got pretty good at it. Sometimes Jackie would have a nightmare and would bump open his dad's door and climb into bed with him. The little boy would lay tight against his dad, and Jack would gently stroke his son's hair until he fell asleep again. One evening, he and Sammy were drinking beers out on the screen porch. Mickey and Liam were at the top of the lighthouse having one last practice before the competition. The two boys were down on the beach, building the last sandcastle of the day. The sun had just begun its descent, flaming the sky red and burning parts of it orange. Sammy looked over at his friend. "Life good?" Jack nodded. "Life is definitely good."
"Summer's almost over."
"I know."
"Plans?"
"Still thinking about it." Jack gazed at him. "You?"
"Still thinking about it."
They both turned when someone knocked on the door to the porch. It was Jenna.
"I came to pick up Liam and all his drum stuff,"
she said, joining them.
"Big day tomorrow. They need to get their rest."
Sammy said,
"I'll go help them."
Before either of them could say anything, he headed on down, leaving Jack and Jenna alone.
"So what happened?"
she asked. Jack looked over at her. "What?"
"You're a changed man, Jack Armstrong. I was just wondering why."
He finished his beer. "This will sound really corny, but sometimes when a person opens their eyes, they can actually see," he said.
"I'm happy for you. I really am."
"You were a big part of it, Jenna." She waved this off.
"You would have figured it out on your own."
"I don't know about that. I hadn't figured it out for a long time." They both looked out to the ocean and then to the lighthouse. "Never got it to work," he said.
"Sometimes things don't seem to work unless you really need them to."
He nodded slowly. "Going to the competition tomorrow?"
"Are you kidding? Of course."
"Why don't you drive over with us? Sammy's taking their stuff over in the truck and we can all ride in the VW.
"Sounds like a plan."
Jenna left with Liam, and the palace settled down for the night. Jack knocked on Mickey's door and went in. She was sitting on her bed going over the program she and Liam were going to perform. Jack perched on the edge of her bed. "You know that stuff by heart," he said.
"Can never be too prepared."
"Now you're starting to sound like your old man."
"And is that a bad thing?"
He gave her a lopsided grin. "I hope not. Look, you're going to do great tomorrow, win or not." She stared at him over the top of her musical sheets.
"Oh, Dad, we're like so going to win."
"Nothing wrong with confidence, but don't get cocky."
"It's not that. I've checked out all the other acts. I even saw a video of Tiffany's little baton twirl from last year. She's mediocre at best. I have no idea how she won 3 years in a row. Well, I do have an idea. Her mother runs the show, but nobody has worked as hard as Liam and I have.
Well, whatever happens, I'll be out there in the audience cheering for you. He rose to go. But you do need a good night's sleep, so not up too late, okay? He turned to the door.
Dad?
He turned back to her. Yamek? She got off the bed, wrapped her arms around him, and squeezed.
Thank you, Daddy.
Jack wrapped his arms around her. For what, baby? She looked up at him.
For coming back to us.
Chapter 56.
Okay, we're on next to last,
said Mickey, coming backstage at the Playhouse. Liam looked at her. Who's last? Mickey made a face.
Who do you think? Miss Reigning Champion. That way she gets a look at all the competition and her performance is the clearest in the judges' minds.
Liam shrugged. I don't think it'll matter. I've seen the judges. They're all cronies of her mom's.
Keep the faith. We've worked our butts off, and we've got a terrific act.
How's the crowd?
Big, with our families smack in the middle.
When Mickey turned back around, Tiffany stood there wearing a short white robe. Mickey eyed her.
Saving the debut of the skimpy for the crowd? My daddy always said you don't give it away for free, sweetie.
She looked Mickey up and down.
But then if you don't have anything somebody wants, I guess you have to give it away.
Mickey smirked.
Wow, that's really deep. So do you do flaming batons?
Tiffany looked at her like she was insane.
No, why would I? That stuff is dangerous. Well, to beat us, you're going to have to get out of your comfort zone, because the level of competition just got stepped up big time, sweetie.
Tiffany laughed, but Mickey could tell by the sudden look of uncertainty in the girl's eye that she had done what she'd intended to do, freeze her opponent. Before the competition began, she and Liam went out to the audience to see their families. The Armstrongs, Sammy, Charles Pinckney, and Jenna were all sitting together. Jenna smiled and gave Mickey and her son hugs.
I'm really proud of you two.
Knock 'em dead, called out Corey.
Yeah, dead,
yelled Jackie. Chelsea Murdoch walked by with her entourage. Her dress was too tight and too short, and her heels too high for her age. She looked like what she was, her daughter, only a quarter century older. She eyed Jenna.
Haven't seen you here before. Never had a reason to come before, Chelsea,
said Jenna.
This is Liam's first time competing.
Murdoch smiled condescendingly.
Tiffany's going for four straight. Crowd always loves her routine. She's thinking of carrying on baton in college,
she added loftily.
Well, good for her,
piped in Mickey.
It's always nice to have a career plan.
Before Murdoch could say anything, Mickey added,
Okay, we gotta go. Show's about to start.
Good luck, Mick, said Jack. Looking dead at Tiffany's mom, she said,
It won't be about luck, Dad. Like the sign says, it's a talent competition.
There were 21 acts, mostly younger people, but there was an older barbershop quartet that was pretty good. Mickey watched from the side of the stage, mentally calculating where the serious competition was. Liam just stayed backstage chilling and idly tapping his sticks together. She came back to him and strapped on her guitar.
It's showtime, big guy.
Cool. I was about to fall asleep.
Now that's exactly what I need, a drummer with ice in his veins.
Liam smiled. Let's rock this sleepy little town.
Oh yeah,
said Mickey. Chapter 57. At first, the beat was mellow. Still, the crowd whooped and clapped. Sensing the rising energy, Mickey gave Liam the cue they'd practiced. She cranked her amp and stomped on her wah-wah pedal, and her hands started flying across the face of the Fender guitar. They dove right into a classic Queen roof blaster, with Liam moving so fast he appeared to be two people, alternating between drums and keyboard. The crowd was on its feet, singing the lyrics. Mickey knew that once you had the crowd right where you wanted them, and they thought you'd already given everything that was in your tank, you did something special. You gave them more. She unplugged her amp and pulled off her guitar. She actually pitched it across the stage. At the same moment, Liam tossed his stick in the other direction. She snagged the sticks, he caught the fender, and they exchanged positions. Liam plugged in the amp and became the guitarist, his long fingers expertly traversing the fender. Mickey perched on the stool and hammered away at the full array of the drum set. The finale was a dual one, with a solo each. Mickey rocked the house with a 6-minute broadside and finished up with a mighty crescendo, her hands moving so fast there appeared to be 6 pairs of them. And when the audience didn't have any breath left and their palms were raw from clapping, Liam performed a guitar solo that would have made Jimmy Page and Santana proud. He held the last chord for a full minute, the amp-powered beat shaking the Channing Playhouse like cannon fire. And then there was silence, but only for a few seconds as the crowd caught its collective breath, and then the applause and screams and cheers came in waves. Mickey held hands with Liam and took bow after bow. They finally had to motion for the people to sit down and stop applauding. As they went backstage, the other performers rushed up to congratulate them. "You rock," said the 50-ish baritone in the barbershop quartet. "You took me back to my 3-dog night days." Breathless and wearing wide grins, Liam and Mickey moved off to the side. Tiffany passed by them, not saying a word. She loosened her robe and let it fall off. The outfit underneath did not leave much, if anything, to the imagination. She turned to them, and using her fingers, formed an L on her forehead. Mickey pointed to the stage.
"You're not a loser yet. That comes later, sweetie."
Other than stumbling twice and nearly dropping her baton, Tiffany did okay. The applause was polite, except for the section led by her mother, which lasted so long that finally some people turned in their seats to see who was still applauding what had been a fairly mediocre performance. A few minutes later, all the contestants were called to the stage in a single group. Mickey found her dad in the crowd and gave a thumbs up. Jack gave her 2 thumbs up back, while Sammy extended a crisp salute. Corey did an elaborate bow to his sister's dominance on the stage, and Jackie copied him. Jenna caught Liam's eye and blew him a kiss. The head judge stood and cleared her throat.
"We have reached our decisions, but first I would like to thank all the contestants for their fine performances."
This statement was followed by polite applause.
"Now, in third place, Judy Ringer for her sterling dance performance of the Nutcracker."
Judy, a skinny 14-year-old, ran out to get her trophy and a bouquet of flowers.
"Thank you, Judy. Now, in second place, we have Dickie Dean and his Barbershop 4.
The man who had lauded Mickey and Liam's performance hustled out and received the award for his group as the crowd clapped.
"And now, for the first place champion."
The crowd held its collective breath. The judge cleared her throat one more time.
"For the 4th year in a row, Tiffany Murdoch and her fabulous baton routine."
Tiffany stepped forward all smiles and whisked over to get her trophy, $100 check, and flowers while her mother beamed. Trophy and flowers in hand, Tiffany strode to the microphone.
"I'm truly overwhelmed with gratitude. 4 years in a row. Who would have thought it possible? Now I'd like to thank the judges and..."
"That's a load of crap," bellowed a voice. All heads turned, including Jack's and Jenna's, to see Corey standing up on his seat and pointing an accusing finger at the head judge. "This sucks," roared Corey.
"This sucks,"
repeated Jackie, who was standing on his chair and pointing his finger too. "Core," snapped Jack. "Jackie, get down and be quiet." But Jenna put a hand on his arm.
"No, you know what? They're right.
She stood and yelled.
This stinks.
Jack shrugged, stood, and called out, Are you telling me that Mickey and Liam didn't even make the top three? You people are nuts. The head judge and Chelsea Murdoch scowled back at them. Another chorus came from farther back in the theater. Mickey craned her neck to see. It was Blake and some of the other people from Sweat Town, including Fran, the woman who'd worked as a caterer at Tiffany's party. Recount, demanded Blake. Recount. Mickey grinned at him. Recount! Recount! Chanted the crowd. Tiffany stood at the center of the stage trying to pretend she was oblivious to all of the criticism. She held her trophy and posed for pictures for a photographer from the local paper. Then the crowd started chanting, Encore! Encore! Mickey looked at Liam. He said, What the heck? Let's give him the purple. She nodded, picked up her guitar, cranked her amp, poised her foot on top of her wah-wah pedal, and struck a chord so powerfully amplified that Tiffany screamed and almost fell off the stage. Mickey looked over at Liam and nodded. A moment later, the heart-pumping sound of Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple roared across the theater. Minutes later, as the last note of the song died away, Liam and Mickey, their arms around each other, took a bow together. This was a trigger for the ecstatic, cheering crowd to rush the stage. Tiffany had to run to get out of the way of the stampede. The news photographer and reporter joined the crowd, leaving the baton twirler all alone. Tiffany stormed off the stage and threw her trophy in the trash, while her mother followed her out of the theater, trying to soothe her furious daughter. Later on the drive home, Mickey and Liam sat in the back of the VW bus. The two teens glowed both with the sweat of their musical exertions and also with sheer excitement. Liam said, This is like the greatest day of my life. I mean, I've never felt this good about losing before. Jack looked in the rearview mirror at his daughter. So what happened to alternative edgy beats with a non-traditional mix of instrumentals? She grinned.
Wow, you were listening. I'm impressed. Anyway, sometimes you just can't beat good old rock and roll, Dad.
The best part, said Corey, was watching Tiffany storming off. Jenna looked in the back of the van and tapped Jack on the arm, motioning with her eyes. He gazed in the rearview mirror to see Liam and Mickey sneak a kiss. She whispered,
I think for them, that's the best part.
Chapter 58. Hey, Jack yelled. He and Sammy had just come out of the grocery store in downtown Channing when Jack saw a guy grab his tool belt out of the truck's cargo bay and run off. Jack and Sammy raced after him, Jack a few paces in front. He saw the guy duck down a side street. He turned the corner and accelerated, Sammy right behind him. The side street turned into an alley. Then they left the alley and entered a wider space. But it was a dead end. A blank brick wall faced them. They pulled up, puffing. Jack realized what was going on about the same time Sammy did. Trap, Jack said.
And we just ran into it like a couple of high school knuckleheads.
They looked behind them as five large men holding baseball bats came out of hiding behind a dumpster. Jack could see that the man in the lead was the same one he'd thrown headfirst into the side of the pickup truck shortly after they'd arrived in Channing. The men moved forward as Jack and Sammy fell back until they were against the brick wall. Jack slipped off his belt, coiled it partially around his hand, and stood ready. Sammy rolled up the sleeves of his work shirt and assumed a defensive stance. He beckoned them on with a wave of his hand.
Okay, who wants to go to the hospital first? He said.
With a yell, the biggest man ran forward and raised his bat. Jack whipped his belt, and the metal tip caught the man right on the arm, cutting it open. He screamed and dropped the bat. Sammy drilled a foot into his gut, sending him to his knees. Next, Sammy clamped an iron grip around the big man's neck.
I don't waste my A game on the JV.
Sammy crushed the man's jaw with a sledgehammer right hand that sent him to the asphalt. Sammy looked back up. One down, four to go. Who's the next victim? Two more men, including the one whom Jack had beaten up before, yelled and ran forward. Jack grabbed the man's bat, pivoted his hips, and pulled hard. The man sailed past him and hit the wall, bouncing off. Groggy, he rose in time to be put back down by Jack's fist slamming into his face. The other guy had his feet kicked out from under him by Sammy. He ripped the bat out of the guy's hands and bopped him on the head with it, knocking him out. When Jack and Sammy looked up, the other men had disappeared.
Okay, that was fun, said Sammy.
His smile vanished a minute later when Sheriff Tammy hustled into the alley with a skinny deputy in tow. Tammy took one look at the men lying on the ground and Jack and Sammy holding bats, and he pulled his gun, his face dark and furious.
Put those bats down now. You're both under arrest.
They attacked us, exclaimed Jack, as he and Sammy dropped the bats.
Then how come they're knocked out and you two had the bats?
Because they were crappy fighters, said Sammy. Is that our fault?
Jack pointed at one of the men on the pavement.
Look, he's the same one I fought with before. He and a bunch of his guys came after us to settle the score. We were just defending ourselves.
That's for a court to decide.
You're really charging us? Said Jack. What about the other guys?
Their butts are going to jail, too.
Well, at least that's some justice, snapped Sammy.
And we gotta let the wheels of justice do their thing, just the way it has to be, said Tammy.
Jack and Sammy were cuffed, loaded into the sheriff's cruiser, and transported to the jail. Jack slumped down on a bench at the back of the cell, but Sammy said,
Hey, we get a lawyer, right?
That's what I said when I read you the Miranda card, replied Tammy.
Tammy let Jack make a call. He said,
Jenna, it's Jack. I'm in a little bit of trouble.
10 minutes later, Jenna and Charles Pinckney hurried into the sheriff's office and were escorted back to see the prisoners.
My God, Jack, what happened?
She said. He explained everything that had happened in the alleyway.
I've talked the sheriff into releasing you on your own recognizance,
she said. So we can go?
For now, yes, but it looks like the men are pressing charges, at least according to Tammy.
But isn't it our word against theirs? Said Sammy.
Still have to go to court.
But we didn't do anything wrong.
I'm sorry, Jack,
said Jenna.
I'm doing the best I can.
His anger faded. I know, and I appreciate you getting down here so fast. Didn't know anyone else to call.
Well, for now, you're free to go. I'll get the sheriff.
2 days later, a man in a suit knocked on the door of the palace. Jack answered it.
Jack Armstrong?
Yeah, who are you? The man stuffed some papers into Jack's hand.
Consider yourself served.
The man walked off as Sammy joined Jack at the door.
What is it?
He asked him.
Served with what? Those jerks from the alley really suing us?
Jack read quickly through the legal documents. When he looked up, his eyes held both anger and fear.
No, it's a lot worse. Bonnie is suing for custody of the kids.
Chapter 59.
I can't believe Grandma is doing this,
said Mickey.
Why would she?
The Armstrongs were arrayed on the couch and floor at the palace. Sammy was there, and so were Liam and Jenna. Jack had shown Jenna the documents, and she had read them carefully with her lawyer's eye.
I don't know, said Jack, though he actually had a pretty good idea.
Jenna looked up from the papers.
She's requested an expedited hearing to get temporary custody pending a full hearing. In non-legalese, that means she wants to get in front of a judge fast to get the kids now and then worry about the rest later.
She can do that? Said Sammy.
The courthouse is open to everyone. But she has to prove her case. It's difficult to have children taken away from a parent.
Jack asked, exactly when and where is all this going to happen?
in 2 days, in family court in Charleston.
But we live in Ohio.
But you have property in South Carolina, and you're living here now, if only for the summer. However, I can argue that the South Carolina court lacks jurisdiction.
You can argue? Said Jack.
Do you have anyone else in mind to represent you? I've got a license to practice in South Carolina, and I've kept everything current. Did you practice family law?
Asked Mickey.
I've done some of it, yes, and I know my way around a courtroom.
She held up the documents.
But we don't have much time to prepare.
Jenna, you don't have time to do this. You've got a business to run. Before she could respond, Liam said, I can do that. Mom taught me everything about the business. It'll be fine. Jenna smiled.
See?
Are you sure?
Heck, nice change of pace. You can only bake so many pies before you feel the need to punch somebody. Going to court gives me a chance to whack some idiots. Not literally, of course, but you get the point.
All right, but you're going to bill me for your time.
We'll work something out.
Mickey said,
What exactly is she saying that would make a court take us from Dad?
Jenna's face grew serious, and she looked at Jack questioningly. He nodded. You can tell them.
Basically, that your father is unfit to be your guardian, that he's a danger to himself and others.
That's stupid, said Corey, jumping to his feet. Yeah, stupid, said Jackie, though in an act of surprising independence from his brother, he remained seated, his arms folded defiantly over his little chest.
I'm not agreeing with her, just telling you what she's alleging. Does she have any proof of that?
Said Mickey heatedly.
Of course not, because it's not true. She'll be able to show any proof she has at the hearing.
Jenna explained. She looked at Jack again.
And we have to show proof that you are fit.
How do we do that?
You can testify, so can Mickey and Corey. Jackie's too young, of course. I can get Charles to be a character witness and Sammy here. They can all attest to your fitness. I have no idea what angle she's using, but I can't imagine she'll be able to show the level of proof required to take children away from their surviving parent.
Later, Jack walked Jenna out to her car.
Jack, there is one thing I didn't want to say in front of the kids.
What?
I don't think the timing on Bonnie's action is coincidence. I think it's tied to your arrest for assault. She could have easily found out. And I can guarantee they'll use that to prove their case.
But I'm innocent.
Doesn't matter. It's all perception. And if they can convince the judge you're violent, not good.
Great. Guilty until proven innocent.
Jack, if there's anything to tell me about this, now would be a good time.
What do you mean?
I mean, why you think your mother-in-law is doing this?
She blames me for Lizzie's death. She came here pretending to want to reconcile, but I turned down her offer of moving in with her in Arizona. And she only came by once to see the kids this summer. Some grandparent she is.
That's actually not right, Dad.
They turned to see Mickey standing behind them. What? Said Jack.
Grandma came by like 6 times while you were out working.
You never told me that.
She asked us not to, said you might get mad.
I told her to come and visit. I wouldn't have gotten mad.
Well, that's not what she said.
Jenna looked at her.
What did you talk about?
Mickey shrugged.
Steph, did she ever ask about your dad? Yeah.
Mickey said nervously.
Mickey, you need to tell us everything. We can't be surprised in court.
Mickey started to tear up.
It was when Dad was working so hard and he was out in the lighthouse all the time.
Jack said gently, It's okay, sweetie, I understand. Just tell us what you told her. Mickey calmed.
She asked what your mood was, if you were doing anything strange, if you didn't seem to be feeling well.
And you told her about the lighthouse and... Things? Said Jack. Mickey nodded, a miserable expression on her face.
I'm sorry, Daddy. I didn't know she was going to sue you.
It's not your fault. It'll be okay.
Are you sure?
Absolutely. He looked at Jenna. I've got a great lawyer. Now go back in the house, Mick. Jackie's probably attempting somersaults from one of the ceiling fans.
After she left, Jack looked at Jenna. I lost the kids once. I can't lose them again. She put her hand over his.
Listen to me, Jack. You're not going to lose them, okay? Now I've got to go. Lots of stuff to prepare.
She drove off, leaving Jack standing in the front yard of the palace, looking at the ground and wondering if his second chance was coming to a premature end. Chapter 60. The kids were scrubbed and dressed in their best clothes. Jack and Sammy had bought jackets and dress slacks for the courtroom appearance. Jenna was dressed in a black skirt and jacket, heels and hose. Liam had taken time off work to join them for moral support. He and Mickey sat holding hands in the front row. The courtroom was surprisingly small, and Jack felt immediately claustrophobic as he stepped inside. And it was very quiet. Jack didn't like such quiet. He had sensed it on the battlefield many times. It usually heralded an ambush. The judge was not on the bench yet, but the uniformed bailiff was standing ready. Bonnie's lawyer was already seated at his table. Jack jerked when he saw Bonnie and Fred sitting behind him. Fred was studying his hands, while Bonnie was actively engaged in discussion with her lawyer, and also with another man in a suit. Other than that, the courtroom was empty. As Jack looked at the young man, he suddenly remembered where he'd seen him before, in a car with Bonnie, parked on the streets of Channing. Jenna walked over and spoke with the bailiff for a minute or so before approaching Bonnie's lawyer. They went off to a corner to speak in private. While Bonnie stayed sitting and talking to the other man, who was showing her something on a laptop computer, Jack watched as Bonnie's lawyer handed Jenna a packet of documents. She frowned and asked him something, but he shook his head. She said something else to him that Jack couldn't hear, but it made the other man turn red and scowl. She whipped around and marched back over to Jack. She sat down and pulled her chair closer to him and the kids. At that moment, Sammy walked in with Charles Pinckney. Pinckney greeted Jack, Jenna, and the kids. Then he eyed Bonnie. He surprised Jack by walking over to her. "Fred," he said, "how are you?" Fred O'Toole looked up and seemed surprised to see Pinckney standing there. He took the other man's extended hand. "Fine, Charles, you?" "I've been better, actually, but thank you for asking." He turned to Bonnie, who was gazing steadily at him. "Hello, Bonnie." She nodded curtly.
"Charles."
"Let's just be thankful Lizzie and C aren't alive to see this god-awful spectacle," he said in a tight voice. Bonnie looked like she had been slapped, but Charles had already turned away. Jenna held up the stack of documents and whispered to Jack.
"Opposing counsel just now gave me these documents. I asked him if he would not contest an extension on the hearing date, but he refused."
"What's in those documents?" Jack asked.
"I haven't had a chance to read them, but I've glanced at a few pages. Your mother-in-law apparently has had a private detective follow you this summer."
She pointed to the other man holding the laptop.
"That guy."
"What?" said a shocked Jack.
"That is, like, totally insane,"
added Mickey. Jack gazed nervously at him. "What's he got on the laptop?"
"Apparently some video they intend to show the judge."
"Video? Of what?"
"I don't know."
"I didn't think they could do stuff like this," said Sammy. "Surprise the other side with crap."
"Normally they can't, but this is family court. The rules are different. Everything is supposed to be done with the best interests of the children in mind. That sometimes trumps official procedures, and they're alleging that the children are in an unsafe and even dangerous environment."
"That's poppycock," said Charles.
"And we'll show it,"
promised Jenna. She had previously gone over with them the questions she would ask and what questions to expect the other side to throw at them. A moment later, the bailiff announced the entrance of the judge. He turned out to be a small, thin, balding man with thick spectacles named Leroy Grubbs. They rose on his entrance and then took their seats. The case was called, and Bonnie's lawyer, Bob Patterson, rose. But Jenna cut him off and asked the court for an extension. citing the late delivery of crucial documents. This was denied by Grubbs almost before Jenna finished speaking. Patterson made his opening statement.
Fine. Call your witnesses, said Grubbs.
The lawyer said,
Bonnie O'Toole.
Chapter 61. Bonnie was sworn in and sat down in the witness box.
You're the children's grandmother, asked Patterson.
Yes.
Can you lead us through the series of events leading up to your filing this legal action?
Bonnie spoke about Jack's illness, her daughter's death, Jack being in hospice, the children living with relatives, and Jack's recovery, and his taking the children back. And finally she described her offer to have them all live with her because of her concerns, after consulting with doctors, that Jack's illness would most assuredly come back with fatal results.
And what was Mr. Armstrong's response to your offer?
He categorically refused it.
And what specific event prompted you to have your son-in-law put under surveillance?
I saw Jack beating up two men on the street in Channing, South Carolina, in broad daylight while his children were with him. The youngest, Jackie, was bawling his eyes out. It was awful. It was like Jack had lost his mind. I don't know if it was a symptom of the disease coming back or not, but I was terrified, and I could tell the children were too.
The lawyer finished with Bonnie, and Jenna rose.
Mrs. O'Toole, do you love your grandchildren? Of course I do. And yet you seek to separate them from their father, for their own good. And not to punish Mr. Armstrong? No, of course not. So you're not angry with your son-in-law? You don't blame him for your daughter's death? I've never blamed him. I told him that I knew it was an accident. But did you really believe that? Didn't you tell Mr. Armstrong that you thought he should be dead, and not your daughter?
Bonnie pursed her lips and remained silent.
Mrs. O'Toole, I've tried to move past that. But you still harbor resentment toward him. I don't think so, no. And that is partly the reason you're filing for custody, for revenge.
Objection, said Patterson. The witness has said she harbors no resentment.
Withdrawn. No more questions.
Next witness, said Grubbs.
Jack and the others were surprised to see Sheriff Nathan Tammy amble into the courtroom, not looking too happy about being there. He was sworn in, and Patterson took him through his paces as a witness.
So you warned Mr. Armstrong on the occasion of the first assault he was involved in?
Yes, although I warned the other guys too. Apparently Mr. Armstrong was provoked.
And there was a second more recent assault involving Mr. Armstrong, was there not?
Yes.
Can you tell us the circumstances?
Tammy sighed, glanced at Jack, and explained the altercation in the alley.
So to sum up your testimony, Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Duvall were holding baseball bats in an alley, and three unconscious men were lying at their feet.
The lawyer glanced at the judge, presumably to gauge the man's reaction. The judge was following the line of questioning very closely.
So you arrested Mr. Armstrong and his companion, Mr. Duvall?
Yes, but I arrested the other guys, too.
But Mr. Armstrong will be going to court on these charges.
Yes.
Could he receive prison time?
I really doubt that.
Could he?
Well, yes.
No further questions. Jenna rose.
Sheriff Tammy, why didn't you charge Mr. Armstrong on the first altercation?
Well, from the witness statements, it was clear that he was provoked.
Jenna glanced at Bonnie.
Provoked? How?
Tammy took out his notebook.
Three witnesses said that one of the guys Mr. Armstrong went after had yelled out something about him being the miracle man, and they were willing to pay him $5 to perform a miracle on him. And he said other stuff, trying to get Mr. Armstrong's goat, I guess.
All directed at Mr. Armstrong personally?
Yes.
Did Mr. Armstrong attack at that point when he was the subject of these statements?
No, he just kept walking along with his kids.
Go on.
Tammy looked at his notes. Then the same guy said, "Hey, Miracle, was it true your slutty wife was cheating on you? That why you came back from the dead?" Jenna turned to look at Bonnie in time to see her glance sharply at Jack.
"And is that when Mr. Armstrong went after them, because they insulted his deceased wife?"
"Yes."
"So he exercised admirable restraint when the insults were only directed to him."
"Probably more restraint than I would have exercised if it had been me."
"And the alleged second assault, is it true that one of the men engaged in this assault was also the same man who was involved in the first altercation?"
"Yes."
"So it could have been that these men attacked Mr. Armstrong in that alley, and he was merely defending himself?"
"Objection," said Patterson. "Calls for a conclusion that the witness is not qualified to give." "Sustain," said Grubbs. But he looked curiously at Tammy and then over at Jack. Jenna said,
"No further questions."
Patterson said, "I call Michelle Armstrong to the stand." As Mickey rose and moved forward, she stopped next to her dad. He gave her a reassuring smile and gripped her hand. "Just tell the truth, sweetie," he said. Chapter 62. "Miss Armstrong," said Patterson politely, "you had a number of conversations with your grandmother this summer, didn't you?" Mickey looked at her father, but the lawyer moved to block her view. "You must answer my questions truthfully and not look to your father for instruction." Mickey took a deep breath.
"Yes, I spoke with Grandma."
"And what did you tell her about your father's, actions during the summer?"
"I don't understand the question."
"All right. I mean with regards to the lighthouse, for instance." "Lighthouse?" said the judge. Patterson addressed him. "It was apparently Mr. Armstrong's deceased wife's favorite place as a child, and he was spending most of the nights there." Jenna rose.
"Objection. Mr. Patterson has not been sworn in as a witness, Your Honor, and has no personal knowledge of the situation."
"All right," said Grubbs. "Sustain." Patterson turned back to Mickey. "Your statements about the lighthouse. Can you tell the court, please?" Mickey fidgeted.
"I just told her that Dad was working on the lighthouse, that's all. It was no big deal."
"Would he work out there late at night?"
"Yes."
"With Mr. Duvall?"
"Yes."
"Leaving you three children alone in the house?" Mickey's face grew hot.
"I'm not a child, I'm 16.
"All right, leaving you and your younger brothers alone in the house?"
"Sometimes, but nothing happened."
"On the contrary, did you not tell your grandmother on at least three occasions that your younger brother Jack Jr. got out of bed and once fell down the stairs?" Jack looked shocked. He stared at Mickey. She swallowed hard.
"But he was okay, just a bruise on his back."
"And on another occasion, Jack Jr. wandered out of the house, and you couldn't find him for at least an hour, and he turned up walking down the street." Jack slumped back in his chair, totally flummoxed.
"Yes, but he was okay."
"And did you tell your father about these incidents?"
"No."
"Why not?"
I didn't want him to get upset."
"Does he get upset often?"
"Well, I mean, no. No, he doesn't."
"Did you also tell your grandmother that your dad was obsessed with the house and the lighthouse because your deceased mother loved it so much there and he was trying to reconnect somehow with her?" Mickey flushed a deep red and started breathing quickly. Tears trickled from her eyes.
"I was mad at him. That's why I said those things."
"So they weren't true? Remember, you are under oath." Jenna rose.
"Your Honor, counsel is badgering. I request a recess so the witness can compose herself."
Grubbs looked at Mickey. "Are you all right?" Mickey drew a deep breath, wiped her eyes, and nodded.
"I'm okay."
"Proceed." Patterson continued. "And did you also tell your grandmother that your father had no clue how to run a family and didn't seem to care about you and your brothers?"
Jack looked down. Mickey teared up again.
That was before he changed.
Changed? Obviously flustered, Mickey started speaking too fast.
Yes, I mean, he was like that before. No, I mean, not bad. He did love us. I mean, he does love us. He takes great care of us.
But didn't you also tell your grandmother that you were worried about your dad's mental state? In a hushed voice, Mickey said,
No, I don't remember saying that.
So you've never seen your dad acting irrationally or even in a fit of rage?
No, never.
Patterson turned to the man in the suit sitting next to Bonnie. Mr. Drake, if you would. The man rose and wheeled forward a TV on a rolling stand and slid a DVD into a player underneath the TV. Patterson said to the judge, Your Honor, Mr. Drake is a licensed private investigator hired by Mrs. O'Toole to keep watch over the Armstrong children. The video you're about to see represents one of the results of this surveillance. The TV screen came to life and they all watched as Jack came running out of the lighthouse carrying the crate. He smashed it on the rocks and then raced down to the beach, twisting and turning in what looked unmistakably like a fit of insane rage. Then he dropped to the sand and wept. The next image was Mickey creeping up to her father. On Patterson's cue, the DVD was stopped, and he turned back to Mickey. You obviously saw your father that night? Mickey nodded. And you wouldn't describe that behavior as irrational or even a fit of rage?
He was upset, but he got better.
So in your mind, he was sick?
No, that's not what I meant.
She stood.
You're putting words in my mouth.
She cried out. Grubbs said, Young lady, I understand that this is very stressful, but please try to keep your emotions under control. This is a court of law. Mickey sniffled and settled back in her chair. If your father were to fall ill again while you were living with him, who would take care of the family?
I would.
Patterson smiled. You may not be a child, but you're also not of legal age to live alone with your brothers. Mickey looked furious.
And Sammy, he's my dad's best friend.
Ah, Mr. Duval, yes. Patterson glanced at some notes. Did you know that after he returned from Vietnam, Mr. Duval underwent psychiatric counseling? And that he also received 2 drunk driving citations. Sammy erupted from his chair. My whole damn unit was ordered to undergo that counseling because we'd done 2 tours in Nam and seen atrocities you never will, Slick. And those DUIs were over 30 years ago. Never had a damn one since. The judge smashed his gavel down. Another outburst like that, sir, and you will be removed from this courtroom. Patterson turned back to Mickey. So, Mr. Duval will look after you?
Yes,
Mickey said stubbornly. He turned to Drake again and nodded. The TV screen came to life. They watched first as Sammy drove his Harley way too fast and without a helmet. The second scene was Sammy dozing on the beach with a couple of empty beer cans lying next to him as Jackie and Corey played very close to the water. Quite a responsible caretaker, said Patterson dryly. Now, Ms. Armstrong, can you tell us what you think your mother's death did to your father? Jenna jumped to her feet.
Relevance?
We're trying to determine the conditions of the children's environment, Your Honor. The state of mind of the surviving parent is highly relevant. Go ahead. Ms. Armstrong, please answer the question.
He was devastated. We all were.
Is he still devastated?
What do you mean?
Your father has been involved in 2 fights and been arrested for an assault for which he could go to prison. You saw the video of him throwing things and jumping around in a state of fury, and of your 2 brothers being left in the care of Mr. Duval while he was apparently either drunk or asleep. You have given testimony that he neglected his 3 children to work on a lighthouse, resulting in injury to your younger brother. Do you believe those to be the acts of a rational person?
But I told you he's better now.
So he was worse at some point.
Look, I know what you're trying to do, but my dad is not crazy, okay? He's not.
But you're not qualified to make that judgment, are you? It really is for this court to decide if your father is fit to have custody of his children. Mickey stood again, tears streaming down her face.
My dad is not crazy. He loves us. He is a great dad.
Patterson gave her a weak smile. I'm sure you love your dad.
I do,
Mickey said fiercely. And you'd say anything to protect him.
Yes, I would.
Mickey realized her mistake too late. No further questions. As Patterson walked away, Mickey looked at her dad.
I'm sorry, Dad. I'm really sorry.
Jack said quietly, It's okay, sweetie. When Jenna rose to question Mickey, Jack put a hand on her arm and shook his head. No, Jenna. She's been through enough.
But Jack...
Enough, said Jack firmly. Jenna turned to the judge.
No questions,
she said reluctantly. Grubbs looked at Patterson. Any more witnesses? Just one, Your Honor, before we rest our case. Patterson turned toward the table where Jenna was sitting. We call Jack Armstrong. Chapter 63. Jack was sworn in and settled uncomfortably into the witness box, hitching his suit jacket around him. Patterson approached. Mr. Armstrong, did you know that your illness can cause severe depression and even mental instability? I don't have an illness. Excuse me? I was given a clean bill of health. Look at me. Does it seem to you like I'm dying? Patterson picked up some documents and handed them to the bailiff. These are opinions from three doctors, all world-class physicians, who state categorically that there is no cure for your illness and that it is fatal 100% of the time. Then they'll have to change that to 99.9%, won't they? Do you blame yourself for your wife's death, Mr. Armstrong? A person will always blame themselves, even if they could do nothing to prevent it.